The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 6. I went home with a feeling of exultation. My scheme had succeeded far better than I could possibly have hoped. Lord Nasby had been positively genial. It only now remained for me to make good, as he expressed it. Once locked in my own room, I took out my precious piece of paper and studied it attentively. Here was the clue to the mystery. To begin with, what did the figures represent? There were five of them, and a dot after the first two. 17, 122, I murmured. That didn't seem to lead to anything. Next, I added them up. That's often done in works of fiction and leads to surprising deductions. 1 and 7 make 8, and 1 is 9, and 2 are 11, and 2 are 13. 13. Fateful number. Was this a warning to me to leave the whole thing alone? Very possibly. Anyway, except as a warning, it seemed to be singularly useless. I declined to believe that any conspirator would take that way of writing 13 in real life. If he meant 13, he'd write 13. 1, 3, like that. There was a space between the 1 and the 2. I accordingly subtracted 22 from 171. The result was 159. I did it again and made it 149. These arithmetical exercises were doubtless excellent practice, but as regarded the solution of the mystery, they seemed totally ineffectual. I left arithmetic alone, not attempting fancy division or multiplication, and went on to the words. Kilmorden Castle. That was something definite. A place. Probably the cradle of an aristocratic family. Missing heir? Claimant to title? Or possibly a picturesque ruin? Buried treasure? Yes, on the whole, I incline to the theory of buried treasure. Figures always go with buried treasure. 1 pace to the right, 7 paces to the left, dig 1 foot, descend 22 steps, that sort of idea. I could work out that later. The thing was to get to Kilmorden Castle as quickly as possible. I made a strategic sally from my room and returned laden with books of reference. Who's Who, Whittaker, A Gazetteer, A History of Scotch Ancestral Homes, and Somebody or Other's British Isles. Time passed. I searched diligently, but with growing annoyance. Finally, I shut the last book with a bang. There appeared to be no such place as Kilmorden Castle. Here was an unexpected check. There must be such a place. Why should anyone invent a name like that and write it down on a piece of paper? Absurd. Another idea occurred to me. Possibly it was a castellated abomination in the suburbs, with a high-sounding name invented by its owner. But if so, it was going to be extraordinarily hard to find. I sat back gloomily on my heels. I always sit on the floor to do anything really important, and wondered how on earth I was to set about it. Was there any other line I could follow? I reflected earnestly and then sprang to my feet delightedly. Of course, I must visit the scene of the crime. Always done by the best sleuths, and no matter how long afterwards it may be, they always find something that the police have overlooked. My course was clear. I must go to Marlowe. But how was I to get into the house? I discarded several adventurous methods and plumped for stern simplicity. The house had been to let, presumably was still to let. I would be a prospective tenant. I also decided on attacking the local house agents, as having fewer houses on their books. Here, however, I reckoned without my host. A pleasant clerk produced particulars of about 6 desirable properties. It took all my ingenuity to find objections to them. In the end, I feared I had drawn a blank. "And you've really nothing else?" I asked, gazing pathetically into the clerk's eyes. "Something right on the river, and with a fair amount of garden and a small lodge, I added, summing up the main points of the Mill House as I had gathered them from the papers. "Well, of course, there's Sir Eustace Pedler's place," said the man doubtfully. "The Mill House, you know."
"No, not where,"
I faltered. Really, faltering is getting to be my strong point. "That's it, where the murder took place. But perhaps you wouldn't like..."
"Oh, I don't think I should mind," I said with an appearance of rallying. I felt my bona fides was now quite established. "And perhaps I might get it cheap, in the circumstances."
A master touch, that, I thought. "Well, it's possible. There's no pretending that it'll be easy to let now. Servants and all that, you know. If you like the place after you've seen it, I should advise you to make an offer. Shall I write you out an order?"
"If you please."
A quarter of an hour later, I was at the lodge of the Mill House. In answer to my knock, the door flew open, and a tall, middle-aged woman literally bounced out.
"Nobody can go into the house, do you hear that? Fairly sick of you reporters, I am. Sir Eustace's orders are..."
"I understood the house was to let," I said freezingly, holding out my order.
"Of course, if it's already taken..."
"Oh, I'm sure. I beg your pardon, miss. I've been fairly pestered with these newspaper people. Not a minute's peace. No, the house isn't let, nor likely to be now."
"Are the drains wrong?" I asked in an anxious whisper.
"Oh, Lord, miss, the drains is all right. But surely you've heard about that foreign lady as was done to death here."
"I believe I did read something about it in the papers," I said carelessly. My indifference piqued the good woman. If I had betrayed any interest, she would probably have closed up like an oyster. As it was, she positively bridled.
"I should say you did, miss. It's been in all the papers. The Daily Budget's out still to catch the man who did it. It seems, according to them, as our police are no good at all. Well, I hope they'll get him. Although a nice-looking young fellow he was, and no mistake, a kind of soldierly look about him. Ah, well, I dare say he'd been wounded in the war, and sometimes they go a bit queer afterwards. My sister's boy did. Perhaps she'd used him bad. They're a bad lot, those foreigners. Though she was a fine-looking woman. Stood there where you're standing now."
"Was she dark or fair?" I ventured. "You can't tell from these newspaper portraits."
"Dark hair and a very white face. Too white for nature, I thought. And her lips reddened something cruel. I don't like to see it. A little powder now and then's quite another thing."
We were conversing like old friends now. I put another question. "Did she seem nervous or upset at all?"
"Not a bit. She was smiling to herself, quiet-like, as though she was amused at something. That's why you could have knocked me down with a feather when, the next afternoon, those people came running out calling for the police and saying there'd been murder done. I shall never get over it. And as for setting foot in that house after dark, I wouldn't do it. Not if it was ever so. Why, I wouldn't even stay here at the lodge if Sir Eustace hadn't been down on his bended knees to me."
"I thought Sir Eustace Pedler was at Cannes."
"So he was, miss. He come back to England when he heard the news. And as to the bended knees, that was a figure of speech. His secretary, Mr. Paget, having offered us double pay to stay on. And as my John says, money is money nowadays."
I concurred heartily with John's by no means original remarks.
"The young man now," said Mrs. James, reverting suddenly to a former point in her conversation, "he was upset. His eyes, light eyes they were, I noticed them particular, was all shining. Excited, I thought, but I never dreamt of anything being wrong, not even when he come out looking all queer."
"How long was he in the house?"
"Oh, not long. Matter of 5 minutes, maybe."
"How tall was he, do you think? About 6 foot?"
"I should say so, maybe."
"He was clean-shaven, you say?"
"Yes, miss. Not even one of those toothbrush mustaches."
"Was his chin at all shiny?" I asked on a sudden impulse.
Mrs. James stared at me with awe.
"Well, now you come to mention it, miss."
"It was! How did you know?"
It's a curious thing, but murderers often have shiny chins, I explained wildly. Mrs. James accepted the statement in all good faith. Really now, miss, I never heard that before. You didn't notice what kind of head he had, I suppose. Just the ordinary kind, miss. I'll fetch you the keys, shall I? I accepted them and went on my way to the mill house. My reconstruction so far I considered good. All along I'd realized that the differences between the man Mrs. James had described and my tube doctor were those of non-essentials. An overcoat, a beard, gold-rimmed eyeglasses. The doctor had appeared middle-aged, but I remembered that he'd stooped over the body like a comparatively young man. There had been a suppleness which told of young joints. The victim of the accident, the mothball man, as I call him to myself, and the foreign woman, Mrs. DiCastina, or whatever her real name was, had had an assignation to meet at the mill house. That was how I pieced the thing together. Either because they feared they were being watched or for some other reason, they chose the rather ingenious method of both getting in order to view the same house. Thus, their meeting there might have the appearance of pure chance. That the mothball man had suddenly caught sight of the doctor and that the meeting was totally unexpected and alarming to him was another fact of which I was fairly sure. What had happened next? The doctor had removed his disguise and followed the woman to Marlowe. But it was possible that, had he removed it rather hastily, traces of spirit gum might still linger on his chin. Hence my question to Mrs. James. While occupied with my thoughts, I had arrived at the low, old-fashioned door of the mill house. Unlocking it with the key, I passed inside. The hall was low and dark. The place smelt forlorn and mildewy. In spite of myself, I shivered. Did the woman who'd come here, smiling to herself, a few days ago feel no chill of premonition as she entered this house? I wondered. Did the smile fade from her lips, and did a nameless dread close round her heart? Or had she gone upstairs, smiling still, unconscious of the doom that was so soon to overtake her? My heart beat a little faster. Was the house really empty? Was doom waiting for me also? For the first time, I understood the meaning of the much-used word atmosphere. There was an atmosphere in this house, an atmosphere of cruelty, of menace, of evil. Chapter 7. Shaking off the feelings that oppressed me, I went quickly upstairs. I had no difficulty in finding the room of the tragedy. On the day the body was discovered, it had rained heavily, and large muddy boots had trampled the uncarpeted floor in every direction. I wondered if the murderer had left any footmarks the previous day. It was likely that the police would be reticent on the subject if he had, but on consideration, I decided it was unlikely. The weather had been fine and dry. There was nothing of interest about the room. It was almost square with two big bay windows, plain white walls, and a bare floor. The boards, being stained round the edges where the carpet had ceased. I searched it carefully, but there was not so much as a pin lying about. The gifted young detective did not seem likely to discover a neglected clue. I had brought with me a pencil and notebook. There did not seem much to note, but I duly dotted down a brief sketch of the room to cover my disappointment at the failure of my quest. As I was in the act of returning the pencil to my bag, it slipped from my fingers and rolled along the floor. The mill house was really old, and the floors were very uneven. The pencil rolled steadily, with increasing momentum, until it came to rest under one of the windows. In the recess of each window there was a broad window seat, underneath which there was a cupboard. My pencil was lying right against the cupboard door. The cupboard was shut. But it suddenly occurred to me that if it had been open, my pencil would have rolled inside. I opened the door, and my pencil immediately rolled in and sheltered modestly in the farthest corner. I retrieved it, noting as I did so that, owing to the lack of light and the peculiar formation of the cupboard, one could not see it, but had to feel for it. Apart from my pencil, the cupboard was empty, but being thorough by nature, I tried the one under the opposite window. At first sight, it looked as though that also was empty, but I grubbed about perseveringly and was rewarded by feeling my hand close on a hard paper cylinder which lay in a sort of trough or depression in the far corner of the cupboard. As soon as I had it in my hand, I knew what it was. A roll of Kodak films. Here was a find. I realized, of course, that these films might very well be an old roll belonging to Sir Eustace Pedler, which had rolled in here and had not been found when the cupboard was emptied. But I did not think so. The red paper was far too fresh-looking. It was just as dusty as it would have been had it laid there for 2 or 3 days. That is to say, since the murder. Had it been there for any length of time, it would have been thickly coated. Who had dropped it? The woman or the man? I remembered that the contents of her handbag had appeared to be intact. If it had been jerked open in the struggle and the roll of films had fallen out, surely some of the loose money would have been scattered about also. No, it was not the woman who dropped the films. I sniffed suddenly and suspiciously. Was the smell of mothballs becoming an obsession with me? I could swear that the roll of film smelt of it also. I held them under my nose. They had, as usual, a strong smell of their own. But apart from that, I could clearly detect the odor I disliked so much. I soon found the cause. A minute shred of cloth had caught on a rough edge of the center wood, and that shred was strongly impregnated with the mothballs. At some time or another, the films had been carried in the overcoat pocket of the man who was killed in the tube. Was it he who dropped them? Hardly. His movements were all accounted for. No, it was the other man, the doctor. He had taken the films when he'd taken the paper. It was he who dropped them here during his struggle with the woman. I had got my clue. I would have the role developed, and then I would have further developments to work upon. Very elated, I left the house, returned the keys to Mrs. James, and made my way as quickly as possible to the station. On the way back to town, I took out my paper and studied it afresh. Suddenly, the figures took on a new significance. Suppose they were a date, 17-1-22, the 17th of January, 1922. Surely, that must be it. Idiot that I was not to have thought of it before. But in that case, I must find out the whereabouts of Kilmorden Castle, for today was actually the 14th. 3 days, little enough, almost hopeless when one had no idea of where to look. It was too late to hand in my roll today. I had to hurry home to Kensington so as not to be late for dinner. It occurred to me that there was an easy way of verifying whether some of my conclusions were correct. I asked Mr. Fleming whether there had been a camera among the dead man's belongings. I knew that he'd taken an interest in the case and was conversant with all the details. To my surprise and annoyance, he replied that there had been no camera. All Carton's effects had been gone over very carefully in the hopes of finding something that might throw light upon his state of mind. He was positive that there had been no photographic apparatus of any kind. That was rather a setback to my theory. If he had no camera, why should he be carrying a roll of film? I set out early next morning to take my precious roll to be developed. I was so fussy that I went all the way to Regent Street to the big Kodak place. I handed it in and asked for a print of each film. The man finished stacking together a heap of films packed in yellow tin cylinders for the tropics and picked up my roll. He looked at me. "You've made a mistake, I think," he said, smiling. "Oh, no," I said. "I'm sure I haven't." "You've given me the wrong roll. This is an unexposed one." I walked out with what dignity I could muster. I dare say it's good for one, now and again, to realize what an idiot one can be. But nobody relishes the process. And then, just as I was passing one of the big shipping offices, I came to a sudden halt. In the window was a beautiful model of one of the company's boats, and it was labeled Kenilworth Castle. A wild idea shot through my brain. I pushed the door open and went in. I went up to the counter, and in faltering voice, genuine this time, I murmured, "Kilmorden Castle?" "On the 17th from Southampton. Cape Town? First or second class?" "How much is it?" "First class, £87. I interrupted him. The coincidence was too much for me. Exactly the amount of my legacy. I would put all my eggs in one basket. "First class," I said. I was now definitely committed to the adventure.